I'd like to thank you all for tuning back into my show. This is Richard Arlen Blake, and this is my next episode of Balladish Anish Folklore Now. In my previous episode, I talked a bit about space and place, and how a lot of times names of places reflect the culture and the history around that specific place. When names are created, they are created by the people who live there. These particular names a lot of times can also reflect and change how people understand a certain place. But now I'm going to go back to what I had been doing before about folklore of specific states. When we go to each of the states, of course, there are different cultural aspects to them. Each of them was formed in a different way and has a different history behind them. I have already talked to you about Rhode Island, Delaware, and Maryland. While I could certainly have done a lot more into delving into slight regionalism areas in there if I was given a good chance to do so, but since I'm not really as in tune to all of the little intricacies of those states, I didn't go beyond certain basic facts and things that just about anyone can come up with when looking into the culture of those specific states. I, of course, would encourage anybody to go deeper into what those states really contribute to the folklore and traditions in America and regionalism. The next state I plan on doing, of course, is something that really holds a lot of feeling to me because it is my state of origin. I am originally from California, and no matter where I go and where I live, a part of me is always thinking back to my roots, my origins that were from California. While I was starting to dig into folklore here of California, I have to point out that California, it's a very large state, and it also has a kind of divide to it that is North and South California. For those of us who are from California, we really know the feeling of Northern and Southern California. If you are from Northern California, you know it. If you're from Southern California, you know it. And the people in the other part don't quite relate to things the same way you do. As I started going in through a few things and reflecting back on my own life in California, I suddenly realized, my gosh, California is so huge, and I know I have so much experience and I know so many things about it that I cannot possibly do California in one podcast. So what I've decided to do is I was going to break it down into several different segments of this particular podcast. First, I will be doing Northern California, and then I will be doing Southern California. But there is definitely going to be more than one podcast dealing with Northern California. And as I discuss things with people that I know from Southern California, I am going to see if they can give me some insights about things down there, because my knowledge is largely in the north. And to begin with, it's kind of difficult to know exactly where to begin your folkloric studies in Northern California. What I am going to end up doing is talking about the part of Northern California that I'm originally from, because there are a couple really interesting things in that part of California, especially around a place called Mount Diablo. Then there is the wine country of California that has a lot of interesting intricacies about it that I'm going to discuss. As I did with all of the other states when I was introducing the states, I started with using several things like the state song and state birds get things going, and I felt that that would be a good place to start here. In California, the state bird is the California quail. I'm not sure why that is, because I think the condor is kind of more of a California-specific type bird with more meaning behind it, but the state bird is the quail. The state flower is the golden poppy. When I was growing up, they always told us, do not pick any poppies out of the ground because you will get in big trouble if you do that. I don't know how much big trouble you'd really be in unless you pulled it out of like a field in a park or something, because I know several people who had gone and planted poppies in their own yard. And if you pull poppies in your own yard that you plant yourself, who, you know, I can't imagine you getting in too much trouble for it. Would someone call the cops on you and tell you you pulled poppies out of your yard? I doubt it. Then the state animal is the grizzly bear. I have never seen a grizzly bear except, I think I saw one once in a zoo and that's about it. But grizzly bears are really impressive creatures if you've ever. The state insect is something called the California dog-faced butterfly. And when I saw a picture of this, I thought, you know, that is kind of a nice looking insect. Butterflies are a lot of times really nice to look at. I, for some reason, thought the insect was something called a katydid, which is something that's kind of like a grasshopper with a larger kind of body that's completely green. But apparently that's not it. I think the katydids only live in certain parts of California, and so they're probably not as broadly spread out and therefore not don't qualify as that kind of a recognition. And then the marine mammal is the gray whale. So the gray whales are impressive things to look at as well. You can see them off the coast if you sail out into the ocean off the coast of California, especially if you leave out of San Francisco. I'll be talking about San Francisco in a different podcast because that is definitely something that needs to be discussed there as well. Those are the state emblems. And then the California state song is called I Love You, California. This song is fairly old. I'd say it's a little over 100 years old when it was first made. It was pretty much a song that commemorates the wonders of California, how beautiful certain things are. Unlike Delaware, where the song breaks into the three counties, or Maryland, where the song pretty much gives kind of a history lesson starting around the Revolution and the Civil War. This song just talks about the beauty of California. I'm going to play this for you now, and then once we're done with that, I'll say a few more words, and then I'm going to start talking to you about Mount Diablo. I think you will find Mount Diablo and the folklore around it really interesting.
I love you, California. You're the greatest state of all. Snow-crowned golden sierras keep their watch o'er the valley's bloom. It is there I would be, in our land by the sea, every breeze bearing rich perfume. It is here nature gives of her rarest. It is home, sweet home to me. And I know when I die I shall breathe my last sigh for my sunny California. Fields of yellow grain. I love your summer breezes and I love your winter rain. I love you, land of flowers, land of honey, fruit and wine. I love you, California. You have won this heart of mine. When the snow-crowned golden sierras keep their watch o'er the valley's bloom, it is there I would be, in our land by the sea, every breeze bearing rich perfume. It is here nature gives of her rarest. It is home, sweet home to me. And I know when I die I shall breathe my last sigh for my sunny California. My sunny California.
So what do you think of that song, I Love You, California? Doesn't it have just a wonderful uppity feel to it? I have to tell you, though, that when I was growing up, and even during the times I lived in California before I moved away, I spent a few decades there, of course, I have actually have no recollection of ever hearing that song or hearing that that is the official state song, probably because I never really affiliated anything with state songs. I only heard of and knew of national anthems, not state anthems. And to my knowledge, I don't recall hearing that sung at any special events or having people being inspired by it or talking about it. Like I said, every state but New Jersey does have one of those songs, and I just felt it's necessary for people to know what the state songs are when I go into these particular podcast episodes. Now I'm going to steer towards Mount Diablo. Mount Diablo, when I was growing up, I grew up in the cities of Concord and Clayton. I spent a little more time in Clayton. That's probably why I always tell people I'm originally from Clayton when they ask me where in California I'm from. And then, of course, when they have that blank look on their face, I ask them if they know where Concord is, and they say, okay, yeah. Where I was from, my house, I could step outside into the front yard, look to the left, and there I could see Mount Diablo in the distance. Mount Diablo is the biggest mountain around for miles, and it's over 3,000 feet high. There are a lot of people out there who take great pride in going and hiking up to the top of that mountain, and the surrounding mountains, none of them are nearly quite as big. The one called North Peak is not much smaller than Mount Diablo. I am not completely sure if that's just considered another part of Mount Diablo, just a different peak. Who knows? I might look into that a little later. I'm just kind of reflecting on my experiences with Mount Diablo when I was growing up. Whenever there was snow in the wintertime, it's usually always only ended up on Mount Diablo and the North Peak as well occasionally. It was really a nice view to have, to be able to see that mountain in the distance. When I moved to Clayton and I lived there, Mount Diablo, I could see it from my backyard or from some places in the front yard, otherwise houses were blocking the view of it. But I mean, it's clearly the largest mountain around for miles and miles. When you stand at the top of Mount Diablo, there is a road that you can drive up there to get to the top if you're too lazy to hike it, which I, of course, am a lot of the time. I don't relish spending huge amounts of time hiking mountains, but maybe that's something I ought to contemplate if I want to really appreciate things. From the top of Mount Diablo, you can see things like Loma Prieta to the south and even Yosemite National Park to the east. It's really beautiful scene to be able to look around from the top of that mountain. I didn't always know what I was looking at up there, of course, but Mount Diablo is an amazing place for those who kind of grew up there appreciating it. Now, there are a lot of different ideas surrounding Mount Diablo. You have your Native American traditions where they have their ideas about Mount Diablo, and then there's the European tradition where they have a bunch of stories that they say that they had gotten from Native Americans about what Native Americans believed. But of course, you have to take some of that with a grain of salt because some of that was just kind of made up fiction to sort of fill in some blanks or to make things sound cool. Mount Diablo is obviously a Spanish name, and so clearly the Native Americans didn't call it Diablo unless the natives have kind of forgotten the original Native American name for it. The Spanish kind of colonized and ran things in that area for a few centuries before the Americans took the land away from the Mexicans in that particular case. The Mexicans, of course, kicked the Spanish leaders out in the 1800s, but then the Americans went in and took it away from the Mexicans in 1848. Mount Diablo, going back to that, the local Native Americans, you have the Miwok, you have several branches of the Ohlone Indians that are largely around the San Francisco Bay Area, but several of them do move up north a little bit. and then the Pomo, who are a bit north around Clear Lake, which is a little ways up from Concord, where I'm from. It takes about 4 hours to drive from Concord to Clear Lake, but that's basically because you have to drive through some mountains to get there. And the Native American traditions and understandings, there are some things collected here. Some of these stories emphasize and talk about the coyote and the eagle, and those two animals a lot of times are the creators of the world, or they are the bringers of fire to the native people there. The people in the mountains who were surrounded by darkness and they could not see, coyote was not able to bring the fire to them. And so what Coyote had to do was he had to go down into the valley and put people to sleep. And then through a reed of his pipe, he sucked out some of the fire and brought it up to Mount Diablo into the mountains for the people to be able to see the light. Then, of course, there is another tradition where the earth is supposed to be completely covered by water after its creation. And there were just two islands that were known to exist here in the water. And those two islands are Reed's Peak and Mount Diablo. And for a long time, those were the only places that were above the water. And then when the water receded, the valleys opened up and the people were able to go and behold the great lands where the gods looked down upon those who resided in the valleys. Then one form of the story that deals with Coyote Man and about the fire being brought up into the mountains is that fire from the valleys apparently was leaving a lot of places dark, and it wasn't until Coyote Man or a surrogate, someone that brought that fire up onto the top of Mount Diablo, and then that is what lit up the world that used to be in darkness. The mountain that was once only an island, of course, is now a mountain, and the people who reside in the valley were averse to letting the people in the mountains have access to it, and these divinities that assisted the people in the mountains had to sort of snatch it away from those in the valley while they were asleep. According to tradition, the messenger who had gone down to get fire ended up putting those people to sleep so that they didn't know what was happening. This mountain clearly did hold religious significance to the Native Americans who lived there. When the colonists from Europe, the Europeans, started to filter their way in there, especially after the gold rush is when California was overrun, the people came up with their own ideas about Mount Diablo and what the Native Americans may have thought about it, one of which follows along the lines of America kind of being an empty place for the Europeans to come and settle in. There was a conceived notion, or perhaps I should say there was the idea that if America was vacant, then the migrants can go and settle wherever they pleased. Several stories came about that essentially said that people once lived there, and what they ended up doing was fighting each other and killing each other off. And it was at the base of Mount Diablo that a lot of this happened, where evil spirits, the devil, had inspired them to go and kill each other. Or there's the idea that the mountain was something that involved some form of devil worship, as the Europeans would have understood it. After all, if you're not Christians and worshiping the Judeo-Christian God, it has to be some kind of devil worship. But a lot of the traditions, of course, and understandings, some of the Native American tribes around today do kind of have their own ideas about them. Not too many of them have them written down. I might have to go and look to find some more things that I can say about how Mount Diablo got this affiliation. But considering my time constraints, I'm going to have to just leave it there for now. One little aspect of Mount Diablo history that I think you might find interesting was that people who were property owners or who were trying to do real estate deals around where Mount Diablo was were trying to find some kind of name that they could come up with so that it didn't have such a negative connotation to it, you know, Devil Mountain, oh my gosh, we have to change that name or people are not going to be happy with being living in that particular area. A group of people actually went to the state legislature at one time and they attempted to convince the state legislature to pass a law changing the name of the mountain to something else. They came up with some funny Native American sounding names that really didn't translate to anything in any known Native American languages. Granted, not every Native American tribe that was around back then is around now, though there are several that are clearly akin to them. Another name that they tried to kind of throw out there was Laughing Mountain. They started fiddling around with some weird Native American linguistic words and things, trying to come up with an idea that would make Mount Diablo's area sound really a lot more appealing. But after contemplating things a bit, the state legislature decided to hold off on any kind of name change for that mountain. That mountain had been known as Mount Diablo in official records for a long time. Felt no reason to go and change this name. Mount Diablo does not necessarily mean that it's a horrible place to live. It's just a name that has been given some kind of designation like that. That is where things stand right now, and I have never heard of anyone trying to change the name of Mount Diablo since then. That was back in 1915, I believe. Now that I've spoken about Mount Diablo and a lot of the traditions around it and the way people understand it, there's just so many things that I could have said, but I just did not have enough time for. I could have done an entire podcast on Mount Diablo, but I didn't want to necessarily get that little nitty-gritty into things in California because I wanted to be able to talk about several different things per podcast. And talking about that, you know, around Mount Diablo, there are several towns besides Concord and Clayton where I live. A couple of them are Walnut Creek, Pleasant Hill. As you can tell by the name, Walnut Creek, that used to be a place where there were a lot of walnut orchards, but that has not been the case for quite some time. When I was younger, driving through Walnut Creek, I never at any time ever saw a walnut orchard. Maybe I just didn't know where to look, who knows. But Concord, California, where I live, there used to be a lot of wineries that were there. A lot of vines and things that scattered around the city of Concord and probably the city of Clayton as well. The city of Clayton didn't expand very much until fairly recently. But right now, the only winery grape orchard that is near there is actually in Martinez, which is actually on the other side of a rather steep hill when you're driving from Concord to Martinez in that direction. The idea of wine and everything brings up another place that I think is worthy of note. There's a magazine dedicated to this wine country that exists in the areas around Sonoma County and some parts of Lake County. And the places in Sonoma County that stand out, you basically, when you're trying to get to the wine country, you drive up, if you're coming from the south, you drive up through Vallejo up on Highway 29. Highway 29 is not a very wide road, but it is significant where it happens to drive. In some of the towns, it is really the only major road. There on Highway 29, you go past Vallejo, you hit a town named American Canyon, and then you go up a bit further until you get to an area called Napa. It's the Napa Valley. Of course, the biggest city in that Napa Valley is the city of Napa itself. And then you continue on and you get to three small towns on Highway 29 that are Yountville, St. Helena, and Calistoga. These three towns are kind of the ones that stand out to me because when you are driving up Highway 29, These are the towns where you actually see vines laying off the side of the road. Yeah, you see the vine fields of the grapes and everything over there. And of course, you're driving past several wineries as you're going. That area is really quite beautiful off of Highway 29. Places like Calistoga, of course, have other things as well there. Like there's a geyser called Old Faithful of California. That is a place worth seeing, I believe. And they also have a petrified forest there in Calistoga. You kind of have to drive around the other side of a hill to get to it, but that is definitely worthy of seeing as well. But wine is the big principal staple of economic activity in this particular area. When I went to American Canyon to help open a Walmart there in American Canyon, because they were closing the one in Vallejo, one of the investigators that got sent there from the government to have a look and make sure everything was going properly in this opening of Walmart pointed out that, yeah, you know, the wine industry is just so huge here. The wine industry essentially pays our checks and pays our bills and pretty much pays for everything government that goes on around there. If you're not a wine drinker, you don't always think about that. I'm not a wine drinker, but I have to admit that this wine industry is a huge cultural center that is in this particular area. When the fires hit this part of Northern California, some parts of the wine country really got wasted and destroyed, and it was a horrible thing to see a lot of these things, especially places that I had been to many times in my life. I had driven up that road, and I saw a picture where it showed a devastated part of the area off of Highway 29, and I could see a fountain on one of the wineries there that I distinctly remember seeing when I pulled off one of the areas where visitors like to go and see to admire the kinds of things that people have built that own these wineries. And this fountain was of stone, and the top of it had kind of tipped over and fallen over. I can just picture in my mind exactly how that looked when everything around it was green and beautiful. Right there, it was like a desolate destruction. Luckily, Calistoga and Yountville were not hit. The fire sort of went in a slightly different direction, even though it did start in the Calistoga area. It went as far south as Santa Rosa, which is where some people I know live. Luckily, Santa Rosa, only the outskirts of it got hit. Santa Rosa is the biggest city in that part of California. If you can just imagine having a city the size of, say, Sacramento suddenly get pounded with fire, that's almost what you would have there with this particular situation. And another winery in particular, actually, that I thought was really interesting is called Castello di Amorosa. So Castello di Amorosa is a winery where, of course, they had a bunch of different kinds of wines that they make there. And as its name indicates, there is actually a castle there on that winery, on that location. When I talked to the people there who were telling me the history of the place, they're telling me that they actually based it on a castle that exists in Italy, and actually the stones that they used to build this castle came straight from Italy. And I'm thinking, dang, that's real dedication going all the way over to Italy just to get the stones to build this, which also means that they had a lot of money to spend in order to put this up and to create it. One of the things that they do is they have a tour that they do there that's a wine tasting tour, and I really wanted to see this castle. This castle looks so cool. I wanted to go in there. I wanted to look around the castle, stand up over the parapets on the towers, look over the crenellations, and look out over the valley, because there is a good view up there over the valley. It could probably only be beaten by someone taking a hot air balloon in Calistoga, because there is a place actually there in Calistoga where you could take a hot air balloon and go around the valley. But in Castello di Amorosa, they allow you to go and they show you around this castle, but first you have to take this tour, this wine tasting tour, and I don't drink wine. So it's like, well, I guess I'm just paying for this tour. I don't care about wine, so I'm not going to drink any wine or alcohol or anything. So I'm on this tour, and when I'm on this tour, I noticed they asked all of us where we were from. I told them I was from Concord, Clayton area, which was about a 3-hour drive, 2.5-hour drive from there to St. Helena. I believe this castle was technically in St. Helena's boundaries. And other people said that they were from other parts of California. And then a couple people mentioned they were from New York and a couple other places. And I was thinking, you know, like Ohio and Oklahoma, and they're thinking, wow, they sure came a good distance just to see this California winery. I, of course, didn't realize until much later that there is actually a kind of taste for California wine that's been respected all over the world. Since I'm not a wine drinker, I don't really pay attention to it. A couple people had even come from Italy and from France, which are two other places where wine is made, Burgundy wine, other things like that. And apparently there had been some wine competitions where people had competed with different wines that they have produced in their areas. And apparently there were a couple instances where the California wine ended up winning the competition. And I thought that was really interesting. At the very end of this tour through Castillo de Amorosa, getting back to the story, I was there and they started giving out drinks to people. And I thought, okay, here, you can take my stub to have a drink because I'm not here to drink wine. And everyone's all looking at me going, what? You don't want wine? What are you doing here? I said, well, I wanted to see the castle. Because castles in this part of the world just are not something that you see a lot of. There's a castle in San Jose called Hearst Castle, of course, that I might talk about a bit more at another time and explain its origins. And then there's also one called Viking's Home that is over by Lake Tahoe. But castles are not really a huge thing that you see in the United States, except for people who are trying to kind of replicate or emulate things that they see in other parts of the world. In this wine country, of course, you have wineries where they actually have hay rides, not hay rides exactly, but they have where you can ride carriages around. There's actually a wine train that you can take from one end of the wine country to the other. I don't remember the exact route. I contemplated taking that train just so that I could have a nice view of everything. And of course, they're advertising how wonderful the wine is that they're going to have there, and I wouldn't be drinking it. But taking a train and going and seeing the countryside, though, that is a really awesome idea, a thing that I would totally be looking forward to. The other wineries have other things that draw people's attention to them. They really, really like having tourists come here into this wine country. They love to emphasize kind of a rural culture, even if they are importing some ideas from outside of the country in which you have all these wine industries going on. And if you look on a map, you will note that there are dozens and dozens of wineries just dotting all over the place. They're not all just off of Highway 29, even though Highway 29 is the major road going through there. If you want to pass from one end of the wine country to the other, you generally go through Highway 29. But then there's a lot of veer off things from the main highway to other wineries. So these other wineries, I'm not sure if they don't necessarily encourage visitors or if they just do it a different way. I had someone point out the castle to me at one point when I was in St. Helena, and I sort of stopped off at a shop there that was kind of on the edge of St. Helena. And that person actually told me about that castle once I'd heard about it. My next trip through that area, I just had to go and see that castle, because anything European-style castle-wise or anything that looks like, you know, fountains from the old country, I just really have to have a look at. You are never disappointed when you go through there. And the people there are always really friendly as well, and they try and emphasize what makes their area totally distinct from other parts of the country. you do not necessarily have to be a wine drinker to really appreciate the atmosphere that people have there. And there are, of course, many festivals. There are wine festivals that are going on during different parts of the year. There's a wine tasting festival. There's a grapes festival. I'm trying to remember the exact name of it. I can't remember it off the top of my head. That comes about around Calistoga every year. Of course, it's going to be during the harvesting season when people can gather together. From what I'm told, this all started back decades and decades ago with the early implementations of the wine business there in that particular country, because they were gathering together to either bring together to market what they have, to bring together the people to celebrate what their particular part of the country great. So if you have any other questions, of course, about the wine country, there are other places where you can go and find it. But this is part of California that really stood out to me when I was going and driving to see the places that I had never gone out of my way to see before when I was growing up, but I decided to check when I was much older. I believe that's where I'm going to end things. There's just too much that I can say about this, but there's probably quite a few things that I would end up leaving out that I shouldn't. And so I'll leave that there. As I said, this is the end of part one of my Northern California episode of Balladition-ish. Thank you all for listening to it. And as always, if you have any ideas or questions about folklore that you'd like me to discuss, feel free to email me at folklorenow33@gmail.com. Let me know what kind of things you'd like me to discuss, or if there's anything that you think is important, or even if you have some things that you've recorded yourself that you would like me to play, I can always consider those with what I'm going to be doing in my next podcast. So thank you for tuning in, and I look forward to having you next time on my next episode of Balladish Inish Folklore Now.